Listening to The Perks of Being a Book Lover, a show featuring two friends who've been in the same book club for almost 20 years.
I'm Carrie. My co-host Amy is a person who sometimes talks herself out of things and then gets a case of FOMO, which she shares with me as if I will even understand what she's talking about, because I experience JOMO, the joy of missing out.
I'm Amy, and my co-host Carrie is the queen of one-word text. Very terse, like, no, yes, thumbs up. She's just trying to get rid of me.
Hasn't worked yet. Basically, we're opposites, but we find common ground on our shared love of books. Each week, we chat about what we're reading with each other and sometimes a special guest.
We also dabble in other topics like books in the news, recent book-inspired films, our TBR counts, and general things that tease our brains. We're glad you're with us today. So this week we are playing the nostalgia card. All of the books we mention are backlist in a big way. The majority are at least 15 years old. Our episode is about books that take up space in our heads. They may be books that, when we see them on a shelf, stir up all kinds of feelings or memories from years past, or they are books that simply left a huge impression on us and we think about them from time to time. Even though they're not new and shiny, these books deserve a place on your TBR.
So something else we're doing this episode, I have a couple times interviewed my daughter because she's a big reader, but we do something a little different. Amy is interviewing somebody that she knows really well.
Yeah, this season we decided to occasionally have a special guest that we call our reader in the wild to talk about some genres that they're passionate about that maybe are not things that we read all that often. So this week I interviewed my husband, Chris. He is a huge sci-fi fantasy reader, and I wanted to put my finger on the pulse of what's going on in sci-fi fantasy. It was kind of strange interviewing my husband for this show, but I will say that as I was editing and he was standing there, like working on dinner, I said, I'm editing you right now, and I wish that I could edit you in real life.
I'm sure he loved that.
He said, I bet you would like to edit me in real life. I wish I could just like edit those things that come out of his mouth sometimes. Although I'm sure he would like to do the same for me.
I'm sure. Well, really, you know, I mean, we shouldn't really call him reader in the wild. It should be like domesticated reader in our house, you know. And we will never hear from my husband. I ask him if he would, because he likes to read sci-fi, and he is like, consider me extinct. I am not in the wild. I am extinct. I'm like, okay. Which I figured that would be the answer I got. So anyway, that's going to be our third segment this week.
But first, a week and a day. We are leaving for LA. I like the way that, you know, rhymes. I'm always excited to go to a book festival because they always energize me and, you know, they're super fun and getting to meet all the authors and collecting books, although the fact that we're flying means that I cannot come back with as many books as I normally would. To be honest, I'm just happy to be taking a trip.
I am too. I'm ready to see something different. Los Angeles has never been a bucket list place for me, but I'm based on some of the reading that I've been doing to prepare for a future episode. There are some things that I'm interested in seeing in LA. Like I want to see one of these canyons. I'd like to do a little hike.
Well, yes. We were looking up things to do in LA. And so we're running an Airbnb there. And Airbnb, you can go on there, even if you're not staying at an Airbnb, and look up their experiences. So they have experiences that you can book wherever they have Airbnbs. And I have done experiences through Airbnb before, and usually they're very good. But I looked up the experiences that you could do in LA, and the one that you circled and sent to me was, let's learn how to surf. And I'm like, no, no learning how to surf.
No, see, actually, when I saw that, I thought Amy learning how to surf and me just sitting on the sand laughing and taking pictures. That was actually what I meant.
I like to look at the ocean. I do not like to be in the ocean. Mm-hmm. I am a little bit scared of water, especially water that moves in big waves and where there's like critters that can eat me underneath. So big, big no on that.
Big no on that one. One was like a tarot moon ceremony or something like that. I'm like, I'm not doing a ceremony. I don't do ceremonies here. I'm sure it's
like crystals and
it's a little woo woo.
It is a little woo woo for these two Midwestern girls, Southern girls. Yeah. But I think we will take a hike, although we want to go to Topanga Canyon and apparently it's mudslides or something there. And I don't know that we're going to be able to do that one.
Well, I looked at a map and it's only a small portion. I think we can get into it in a different way. So we'll see. I mean, I would kind of like to see, at least to say I've been there, to see some of the stars on the Walk of Fame. Yeah. You know, that might be kind of cool. I don't want to stay there very long, but just be like, saw it. Kind of like Chevy Chase when they finally make it to wherever that amusement park is or whatever. And he stands there and bobs his head like, let's go. I have a feeling I'll be a little bit like that with the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So.
Well, and I'm excited to finally meet in person our friend Jennifer Calieras from Books Are Our People. She's going to take us to the LA Festival of Books.
And like I said, she'll be like, oh my gosh, why did I even suggest this? This was such a bad idea.
We have to be on our best behavior. We have to be on our...
I'll try, Jennifer. No promises.
Well, I want to give you an update about my eclipse experience.
Yes, but before you do that, I want to say that your eclipse experience was why I wrote the FOMO section this week.
It is, yes.
So speaking of FOMO, you did experience a little. Yeah, so go ahead and tell the story.
So I wanted to go see the eclipse, but as I said in the last episode, I was a little nervous because a friend had told me that like 100,000 people were supposed to be gathering in this small town in Indiana, Seymour, Indiana, which is where we were planning to go see the eclipse. And I just had visions of me being caught in some cornfield in Indiana with no porta potties or bathrooms. I couldn't go anywhere. I can't get out. I don't know. I'm not claustrophobic as far as like small spaces, but I do get a little claustrophobic if there's like too many people around me. I don't know what you call that. Claustrophobic, but with people. And so the thought of that.
It's called introversion.
Is it?
I think so.
I'm getting more so as I get older. And there was also going to be a chance of cloud cover. And I thought, you know, am I going to go up there and do all this? And then I won't even be able to see it. So I told my husband I didn't think I was going to go. It didn't matter whether I went or not. I mean, logistically, because he was going to go with a mutual friend of ours anyway. And I was perfectly okay not going. I was like, oh, I would like to see it. It's like a bucket list thing, right? And I had heard that it's supposed to be life-changing. And some people put it up there with like witnessing the birth of their child. And I'm like, how could I miss this? Because I don't want to get caught in traffic. But there we are. So my husband went. They left at 7 o'clock. They got there by like 8:30 or 9. There's nobody in this
cornfield.
There's nobody in this cornfield. And so I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's good. And so I did some things I needed to do.
Before that, you texted me. I'd like to read this text back to you.
Okay.
May I do that?
Sure. I don't remember what it was.
Okay. This was at 6:52 a.m. I'm a loser. I decided not to go. The thought of it was stressing me out.
Yes. Yes. It was. I'm like, why am I going to this thing that's like I'm dreading? Why am I doing it? Right.
And then, okay. And so then I texted back at 8:28. What time did he leave? And you said 7 a.m. They are there and it's pretty empty. So maybe I should have gone. And that's when I said, you can always drive up now. That wouldn't be what I would have chosen to do, but you could do that. And so, drum roll. And then at 12:10, I get a text. I'm in Seymour.
Yes. So they were there since like 8:30. I didn't get there till 12:30. So I only had to wait 3 hours and that was too long. I could have come at 2 o'clock and still been able to get a space. Just let me tell you.
I would like to say at 3 o'clock, I texted you and said, are you finding God now?
Did. Yes, you did. I found it interesting. I'm glad I went. I was a little underwhelmed. I did not find it life-changing. I think when somebody tells you that something is going to be life-changing, your expectations are pretty high.
Yeah. Yeah.
It was not life-changing. It was cool, but it didn't ever get completely dark. It got kind of like dusk, you know? But it's lasts for like 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how long can you sit and look at it, really? I mean...
Well, I guess for 4 minutes.
Well, I did not. I looked at it for about a minute. And then I loaded up my, you know, my camping chair.
In the Chevy Chase version of the eclipse. You go, you look, okay, let's go.
That's right. So that we can be out of that parking lot by the time it passed through. And then we were out of there.
To beat the traffic.
To beat the traffic. So I'm glad I went. But had it really been packed and had traffic really been super bad on the way back, I don't know that I probably would have gone. Yeah. So, and then, you know, there are people who follow these eclipses around the world. They're like eclipse chasers. I don't understand it. Maybe. And I listened to podcasts about the eclipse. You know, I really tried to educate myself a little bit about what to expect and why this is cool and all that. So it wasn't for lack of education about it. I mean, I think it was good. It just wasn't
everything that maybe people had built it up to be.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, wow. I guess the thing is, you know, it's kind of everybody has their interests, right? So some people would say that we're crazy for getting in a plane and flying out to Los Angeles for a book festival. Even though we might be like, why would you want to do that and go follow eclipses? Those people would probably say to us, I don't know why you like books so much. That's weird.
That's true.
You know, everybody has their own, their jam, whatever that jam is. Yeah. So
apparently eclipses are not my jam.
Not your thing.
I don't feel the need to go see one again. Let's put it like that.
You're like one and done.
One and done. I can mark it off my bucket list. Yeah. Okay. So, Carrie, what have you been up to? I've been eclipsing. You have been what?
Well, last night I did go see something really cool. I go to see the Broadway Across America series with my friend, and we saw Six last night.
I am very interested to hear about this.
Yeah.
It relates to a book I'm going to talk about later,
okay.
But I am not a musical person, but this one sounds interesting to me.
Yeah, it was an all-female cast. All female musicians, and the musicians were on stage, and the characters were the six wives of Henry VIII. Mm-hmm. And so they were having, it's almost like a battle, and they would perform. And so you're trying to figure out who took the most crap off of Henry. It was really funny. One in particular, so his fourth wife, I believe she was German. Or Flemish, I can't remember.
Is it Anne of Cleves?
Yes, Anne of Cleves.
Uh-huh.
They did a song that I was actually telling my daughter about because my daughter has decided to minor in German.
Oh.
So they did a song called House of Holbein because Henry VIII saw Anne of Cleves' portrait, and that is what made him decide that he wanted to marry her. But then when he met her in person, he was underwhelmed. So the song, when it was talking about how Henry chose Anne based on this portrait, it was sort of like this weird 80s German song, and it had a lot of German references in it, which I mean, since I've been doing Duolingo to learn German, I was able to pick up on quite a few of those, which was pretty funny. So I really enjoyed that. I tend to like the shows that are based in history. I love all the shows. They're always all well done. I would say I have yet to see a bad show or one that I didn't like. But in terms of my anticipation for the show, I am usually more excited about a show that's based in history. So seeing Hamilton or seeing Come From Away, which is about after 9/11. So I think those are sort of more my jam than, you know, Beetlejuice comes next month, and I think it'll be a great show, but I'm like, yeah, it's a movie.
Well, I had heard that the show, The Six, originated at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, which it has like new up-and-coming theater, comics, things like that. Things are like on the fringe a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But then things can take off that way too. And so that's where that show got its start.
It is just six, not the six.
It's not the six?
No, it's just six.
Like the Google or the interweb?
Right. No, it's just six.
Okay. So that's where six, no the, got its start.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, well, so, hey, I do have some book-related show news.
Okay.
So, Neil Gaiman has a new Netflix series coming out. It was from kind of a short-lived comic book that he did called Dead Boy Detectives. And so, that is on Netflix. And so, I'm kind of excited to see that once we get through with the show that we're almost done with.
Have you ever read that comic?
I have not.
The Sandman is like that, too. It started out as a comic that he did.
Yeah, right? Comic book. Yeah.
Well, and you're all about anything Neil Gaiman.
Yeah, I do. I like Neil Gaiman. We've watched Sandman, all the series of that so far. And we watched Good Omens, all the series of that. I mean, he could pretty much do anything and I would tune in for it. So,
well, the one that I'm excited about is the new reimagining of The Talented Mr. Ripley. Mm-hmm. It's just called Ripley and it stars Andrew Scott and Dakota Fanning and Johnny Flynn. I like all those actors. I like Johnny Flynn a lot. He was in movie adaptation of Emma a few years ago, which I loved. But it's in black and white. I think that it starts out a little slow from what I have heard. I've not seen it yet. But once I think you get into it, then people say it's really good. So I think it might be one of those things where for people who maybe just watch one episode of something and say, oh, do I like this or not? I think you might have to watch several episodes maybe to get into it. But our book club read The Talented Mr. Ripley by Patricia Highsmith last summer. And then we rewatched the movie from 1999 that had Jude Law and Matt Damon in it, Gwyneth Paltrow. It was a really good adaptation of the book. In fact, I think a lot of us liked the movie better than the book. Because I have seen that so recently, I'm interested to watch this. Plus, Andrew Scott is really one of my favorite actors. Although, you and I have had this discussion because I have never seen him in a villain-type role. Mm-hmm. I've only ever seen him as the hot priest in Fleabag. And then in another movie he did called Catherine Called Birdie, which is based on a middle grade book where he plays like a king. But he's never been a bad guy. But you said that you've seen him in Sherlock, where he played the ultimate bad guy.
Yeah, he was Moriarty. So he was sketchy as heck. So yeah, when you said that, I was like, really? You know, that was my initial encounter with him as an actor. So I can see him playing lots of different things. But yeah, I can definitely see the villain type.
I've heard him do several interviews, Andrew Scott, about playing Ripley. You know, them asking him, was it kind of hard to inhabit this character for a while? And he said it was. That there's something sort of unknowable, he felt, even, you know, to Ripley himself about himself.
Yeah.
Like why he does the things that he does. So I'm anxious to watch that.
We're talking about shows based on books. Can I talk about the book and show that the book that I've recently finished?
I want to hear it.
Okay.
I want to hear it.
All right. So I read The Three Body Problem by Liu Cixin. I read this book at the same time that I was watching the show on Netflix. And I have to say that I think that I enjoyed the book more from having watched the show at the same time. The novel begins during the Chinese Cultural Revolution with the death of a physics professor. And his daughter, Ye Wingji, watches. Because of her connections to her father, she's sent to an isolated facility in the mountains of China where she sends signals into space with the hope that one day aliens might respond. But she is more or less in prison, right? Because her father was one of the people who was killed. He was an intellectual. Okay. So she's got a lot of anger, trauma, unresolved issues, right? So when aliens do make contact, Ye Wenji basically says in anger, come on then, humans suck. That's what she says. We're horrible. We can't do the right thing. So that's how the book starts. And then decades later, the story introduces a character named Wang Mao, and he's a physicist who sees what the coming of aliens might really be like. Okay, so you kind of have these two time frames in the novel. Okay. All right, so here's the thing. What I liked about this book, I liked what it was saying, the connections it was making about fanaticism. So whether it was sort of like the fanaticism of the Cultural Revolution or the fanaticism about the aliens that will end up coming to Earth based on Ye Wingji's invitation, right? So people start going nuts and they become very extremist. Towards the end of the book, there were some other connections related to the story that I thought were really smart. But what I found, and I have not read a ton of Chinese science fiction, but the ones that I have read, I'm not sure why this is. Maybe it's a translation thing, but I feel like the characters, not that they're not deep, right? But I feel like there's the conveyance of that isn't always what I want. So it's sort of like things seem to happen to characters, but the way it's written, I don't really know much about their internal lives. Mm. And so when bad things happen, I'm kind of like, well, so what?
Mm.
So the good thing about watching the Netflix show kind of in tandem is that the cast is sort of fleshed out. So instead of just having one character, the Wang Mao character, as one person, it's sort of like they split him up. Because of having more of that, you have more interactions. And so you kind of get to know the characters better. And so you see their confusion, their anger, their sadness. Benedict Wong plays a detective. And I like him as an actor. And I feel like he's doing a really good job sort of as the detective who's putting things together and helping the physicists. So I would say if you don't read a whole lot of sci-fi, but you're sort of interested in reading the book, I would recommend reading the book and watching the Netflix show at the same time. So starting the book and then watching the first episode and then read more of the book. And
you felt like the series was fairly faithful to the progression of the book then? It just fleshed it out more? Because it wouldn't necessarily work to read it at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, they do add some things, but I feel like the basic story is the same. And I feel like the things that they add help explain sort of that extremist nature of things a little bit better than maybe what I saw in the book. So I feel like that's a good pairing. I think watching the show made me like the book more, and reading the book and knowing what was going on from that made me like the show more. So
when you were saying you weren't sure if it was translation or the way they're written, but I'm wondering if the United States, you know, we're all about individualism, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think in a place like China and other places around the world, it's not like that. You know, it's more about the nation as a whole, especially, you know, in a communist country like that.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it has anything to do with it.
Well, and it could very well be. I mean, I remember going to Ireland 30 years ago and going to a concert. And I remember somebody who was Irish saying, oh, you can always tell the Americans in a concert because they're so loud and they just lose their minds. And so I think that is kind of an American thing. We're just sort of out there. And I think other cultures tend to be more reserved. You know, like they don't let it all hang out the way Americans do. And so, I mean, that would kind of make sense that would maybe work itself into the writing, you know, and how characters are presented. And sci-fi too, you know, sci-fi and even Dean, and he reads that, like, that's all he reads is sci-fi. But he, you know, we've talked about that, how some writers are really like, they're awesome at the science part, but the human part is not so great. And sometimes the writers who are really good at writing the human part, their science is not so great.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really kind of a sweet spot to find the authors that do both well.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that is my very long-winded discussion of The Three Body Problem by Liu Cixin.
I think that my husband and I will eventually watch that show. He really wants to. I will watch it. I do not think that I would like the book. It doesn't sound like my jam. But the book that I'm going to talk about is related a little bit, but it's a memoir. It's called Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant by Curtis Chin. I listened to this by audio. It came out last October, and it is the story of a Chinese-American family in the Midwest. So the author, Curtis Chin, he is the co-founder of the Asian American Writers Workshop in New York City, and this memoir takes us into the world of him as a kid growing up in a Chinese restaurant family while also discovering his sexuality in the 1980s. So Chin's family ran Chung's, which was one of the most well-known Chinese restaurants in Detroit. His father's family had owned it for several generations. I think that his great-grandfather came over like in the early 20th century. His mother, Chin's mother, came over from Hong Kong when his father married her, brought her over at like the age of 18. And Curtis was the middle child. There were six children in the family, and his father's parents also lived with them. So you get all the personalities of this multi-generational family. Like the grandmother is really cranky and kind of mean. His mother is what you think of as your stereotypical like tiger mom. She didn't want him going over to another kid's house unless it was to study. And his dad was like a little more happy-go-lucky. But this was Detroit in the 1980s, which was very dark days for that city. The auto factories had largely shut down and crime was rampant. But Chung's, their Chinese restaurant, was a place that many kinds of people felt safe to frequent, from the black mayor to visiting Hollywood actors, Jewish families, and even drag queens. So this book gives us a glimpse into life growing up in this multi-generational family restaurant. It gives us Detroit in a time and a place, and it also shows us how Chin dealt with discovering his sexuality as a kid in the conservative Midwest, who for much of his life, he was a rule follower. So the structure of this book was chronological, but the namings of the chapters resembled a Chinese menu, which I think on audio doesn't really translate as well, obviously, as it would reading the book. But I did think that that was kind of a cool thing. If you enjoy a foodie memoir, there is quite a bit of delicious sounding food in here. The author narrates it himself, and his narration is compelling. And this book received the Stonewall Book Award for nonfiction this year. While he does talk about some, you know, darker topics, he has a light tone, sort of a whimsical tone. He makes some jokes in there. So, you know, it's a fairly light, fun listening experience. So, again, the name of that is Everything I Learned in a Chinese Restaurant by Curtis Chin. Much more straightforward than yours.
Yes.
And more tasty. Yours does not sound tasty at all.
I don't know if food was even mentioned at all. It's kind of disappointing.
To me, food makes everything better. Okay. I did want to mention there is a website called the Badass Women's Book Club. And I got news the other day. It was a kind of a surprise. But Cindy Burnett from the podcast Thoughts from a Page, friend of ours, friend of the show, posted that we made their list of 8 bookish podcasts that you should check out, which is kind of cool.
That is cool.
I wanted to check out all the other ones that they had on there. And we've gotten quite a few follows since that came out.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. So thank you, Badass Women's Book Club, for naming us to that list. They have a website, badasswomensbookclub.com, I think, that you can go and check it out on their blog section. We're going to take a little break before we come back and talk about books that take up space in our heads. But before we do, we're going to hear from a fellow book lover who's going to tell us about their most recent 5-star read.
Hi, my name is Casey V from Texas. You can find me on Instagram as KRee_reads. A 5-star read for me has been When the Mood Hatched. This was a 5-star read for me because it felt like something I had never read before. I was instantly sucked in. The magic system and world building were extremely mapped out and set up really well. It had everything that I could have asked for. Dragons, a snarky and sassy assassin, morally gray love interest, slow burn, one horse but on a dragon, fae, and multiple plot twists. I absolutely enjoyed this book, and I hope that if you choose to read it, you do too.
We're back and ready to talk about books that take up space in our brains.
You know, I made a whole list of books. And then when I started thinking about it, a lot of my books revolve around certain times in my life. So you know how they say that, like, you hear a song and it takes you back to a particular moment in time in your life? Well, I kind of do that with books too. So all the books I'm going to talk about today, I really loved, but they also, when I see them on a shelf or I hear somebody talk about them, they bring back a feeling and they bring back a period of time in my life. And I know that I don't think that's the way that yours are organized. I'm just telling people ahead of time, that's the way mine are organized. But the first one I'm going to talk about is It by Stephen King. So this was published in 1986, and this is probably the most memorable book I read as a young adult. I went through a Stephen King phase, like many of us who grew up in the 80s and 90s, but I remember vividly reading this book one summer in high school, sitting on my front porch with my cat on my lap, and it is hefty. It is 1,168 pages. But I tore through it. So I think many of Stephen King's books are cultural touchstones, this one included. I think most people probably have some idea of what it's about, whether you've read the book or you've seen one of the three or four adaptations. But basically, there is a group of seven teenagers growing up in a small town of Derry, Maine, and there's something evil lurking in the town, and its name is It. And it's a demon of some sort who takes the form of a clown and makes its home in the sewer system. So the iconic scene for me in the whole book is when one of these teenagers, little brother Georgie, goes out to play in the rain with his little boat to sail it on the rainwater. And it goes near a rain grate, like a sewer grate. And Georgie bends down to look for his boat and he sees Pennywise the clown and then he disappears. And in fact, our dog Sesame, whenever we're taking a walk, she always stops at all the rain grates and sniffs. And we always say she's looking for the clown. And I won't lie, this book is terrifying, but it's also a great book that really excels in character development. Each of these kids, you feel like they could be your best friend or your brother or your sister. And I was always a big reader, but the summer that I read It was memorable. And I was a voracious reader after that, even more so, I should say. So again, that is It by Stephen King.
Well, I don't have any memorable things necessarily. These books have just stuck in my head. I don't know why. They just have. The first book I'm going to mention is Jack Gance by Ward Just, and that was published in 1997. I read it a long time ago. A friend recommended it to me, and it's a political novel. So Ward Just, the author, was a journalist and war correspondent who knew how Washington, D.C. worked. And so what I remember about the story is Jack, he's the protagonist, and he begins the story with optimism in his eyes and a fire in his belly, right? He is going to change politics for the better. But it becomes obvious as the story progresses and Jack becomes a pollster and later a senator that the political machine will weigh you down and crush your ideals and values. And that's always kind of stuck with me because I think when you're young, I'm sure I read this when I was college age. And when you're younger, you think, oh, I'm going to make a difference in the world, you know, and then you get older and you learn how business works and government works and that it's really hard to make change. And I think we see that in our politics. You know, a lot of times, you know, we have people leaving or saying they're not going to run for re-election because politics can really be nasty and annoying. And anyway, so this book just was sort of a reality check for me at a younger age than I think maybe most people get. But it's so if you like politics, this would be a book that you might be interested in. It's Jack Gance by Ward Just.
Well, my next one was published all the way back in 1977. I did not read it at that time. I was only 5 years old. but it is the Bernie Rodenbaugh series. The first book in that series is Burglars Can't Be Choosers by Lawrence Block. Many readers say that they went through an Agatha Christie phase. I did not. I went through a Lawrence Block phase. So Lawrence Block wrote several different mystery series, but the one that I tore through in my early 20s was the Bernie Rodenbaugh series. But I think that there are 10 or 11 in this series. And Bernie is a used bookstore owner who in Greenwich Village but he's also a gentleman burglar. He only steals from the very rich in New York City, and he steals high-end items like paintings, stamp collections, jewels, or rare books. So no harm, no foul. But he often has to get himself out of bad situations when unexpected murders happen. This series of books, it's light and funny, and the stakes are low, and it's a fun read if you're going to New York City. When I was looking up the names of some of these books, apparently there was a movie made of one of the books, and it was called Burglar. And the producers cast Whoopi Goldberg as Bernie and Bobcat Goldthwait as the nemesis, which I found funny because apparently Bruce Willis was supposed to play Bernie. But then when he backed out, they just decided to hire Whoopi Goldberg. I don't know. And I don't think that the movie did very well. So read the books instead. But what I found out is he's written some more recently. I think I read all the ones that were available at the time, which maybe went up to like 7 or 8 of them. But then there's like 4 or 5 more. And now that we're talking about it, I kind of want to go back and read those extra ones in the series. So again, the name of that, the first one is Burglars Can't Be Choosers by Lawrence Block. And it's the Bernie Rodenbar series. I don't think you have to read them in order. I don't think that it really matters what order you read them in. I think it's probably good to read the first one first, but after that, I don't think it makes any difference. So cool. There you go. So there's sort of a cozy mystery series, you know, a little older, but fun.
All right. Well, I've got a historical fiction now.
Okay.
So this book was published in 2003, and it's called The Good Men by Charmaine Craig. So it's a novel about a priest named Pierre, and it takes place in 14th century France. And Pierre is a priest who loves women, despite his attempts to repress his sexual feelings. He begins an affair with a teenage girl, who's also his niece. And we soon see, that this priest may be in for a reckoning when a friar comes to the village as part of the Spanish Inquisition. Will Pierre burn for his misdeeds, or will his niece take the fall for the sins of her uncle? So what is interesting about this novel is that it was based on depositions that were recorded during the Spanish Inquisition. One of the things that I still remember from this book, it was something I learned at the time that's always stuck with me, is that women of that time used pessaries as a form of birth control.
What's pessaries?
Well, pessaries are sort of like they are insertable. But here's the thing. At that time, they were made of things like animal dung and leaves and vinegar. Anyway, that really stuck with me. So, you know, if you like historical fiction, if you like books about the Spanish Inquisition, The Good Men by Charmaine Craig might be one that you want to check out.
Huh. Wow. 2003 doesn't seem like 20 years old.
Yeah.
Wow. I guess it is because that's the year my daughter was born. I should.
21 years. Yeah.
My next one has some history in it as well, but it is a historical biography and it relates to the show you just saw. It is The Six Wives of Henry VIII by Alison Weir. This was published in 1992. And I went through a phase where I was really interested in Henry VIII and I was reading anything that I could find about that. I was just super curious about that whole situation. I don't know if you think about it, just like marrying six women and you cut off their head. I mean, the whole thing is just sort of fantastical in a way, right?
Actually, so of the six wives, two he executed.
Right.
Two died of cancer and two died as a result of childbirth.
His last wife, she outlived him.
Yes.
And then Anne of Cleves, she kind of went back home, right? I heard that they were sort of friendly, that they were more like friends and that it was annulled. So I was just kind of fascinated with the whole thing. And so this is a historical biography of all the different wives of Henry VIII. And the details about these women's lives is haunting. The author, Alison Weir, really brings them all to life through her research, through journals, letters, and other historical accounts. And while reading a historical biography might sound like it's a little boring, I don't remember this being dry at all. In fact, I think it read a little bit more like it's history, but it reads a little bit more like fiction than a dry textbook. And it was just chilling to me how this one man could be such a monster. And I remember reading this when I was like 8 months pregnant with my first child. And I remember the distinct impression that like a lot of these women died or had pressure to give him an heir, right? Mm-hmm. Like that was like what it was all about. He needed a male heir. And that was why all this was happening. And I don't know, it just struck me a funny way as I was 8 months pregnant with my first child, thinking of myself in their shoes. So if you like history, if you're interested in that time period, I highly recommend The Six Wives of Henry VIII by Alison Weir.
Anne of Cleves died of cancer.
Okay, but I don't think she was married to him.
No.
She just died of cancer in a normal way.
Yeah. Well, and part of it is because the show talks about how they divorced, executed, you know, so they kind of go through what all happens, childbirth. And so that's what, and they have an inclusion, like a historical chart.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So that's, I mean, and it's fresh in my mind because I just saw it last night. So.
Very good.
This is a book that's sort of about men like Henry VIII, sort of about bad actors, right? Like men who just do really crappy things to women. So in just a minute, you'll find out why this book stuck in my head. So the book I'm going to talk about is Eva's Man by Gail Jones. And this was published in 1987. So
I think she didn't, Sam, tell us the Gail Jones
published something recently, yes.
Well, and I think she's a Kentucky writer, or
used
to be.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. Okay. So this story, Eva's Man, is about a woman who poisons her lover and then bites off his penis. Wait, do you see why this stuck in my head? And that lands her in a psychiatric hospital. And through the novel, readers learn about her life and the abuse and the assaults that influence the woman she becomes. It's about racism and sexism and how Black women are supposed to survive under the weight of those things. Eva, however, stays silent after this event with her lover, which I think is an important element of the novel. So who is the reader hearing from? And is it the person that they should be hearing tell the story? So that book always stuck with me. I'd actually like to reread it just because there's a lot that I've forgotten, but you don't forget something like that. Eva's Man by Gail Jones.
Sounds like a Lorena Bobbitt situation.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
If you're so young, you don't remember Lorena Bobbitt, you need to go look that up. So my next one is The House of Sand and Fog by André Debussy III. And this was published in 1999. And my very first book club that I was a part of was when I was newly married and my husband was in medical school. And some of the significant others of the medical students formed a book club, and it became my lifeline to making friends. And one of the most memorable books that I remember reading and discussing in that book club was this one. And I can still remember the anxiety that it made me feel. So in this literary thriller, a woman who is a recovering addict who is down on her luck tries to hold on to her family's home in California and avoid foreclosure. But a recent immigrant, a former Iranian military colonel and his family, buy the house from the bank, and for them, it is a way to try to restore their dignity and have something to call their own in this new and strange country. But when the woman's lover decides to take matters into his own hands and try to win back the love of the woman, these two camps are headed to a devastating conflict. So this book was written in the late 90s, 1999, so it was before the housing crash several decades later, but it still feels very relevant today. And what I remember thinking is that you both were sympathetic to both sides, but you also thought both sides were completely crazy and wrong. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's applicable to a lot of situations, maybe even some like global conflicts, especially. But I mean, this book was just so visceral for me when I read it that I just, whenever I see it, you know, like sitting at a used bookstore or something, it brings back all those feelings to me again. And this was a National Book Award finalist the year that it was published. So again, that one is The House of Sand and Fog by Andre Dubuque III.
Did you ever watch the movie?
No, I did not.
So there's a movie version that came out because I read the book and watched the movie. It came out in 2003.
Uh-huh.
And it stars Jennifer Connelly and Ben Kingsley.
Oh.
And it was really good. You know, if you're looking for a book movie pairing, that's a good pairing. Those read the book and then watch the movie.
Wow. Okay. Yep. Yeah, I didn't realize there was a movie.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. So I am doing an Amy. I forgot how to count to five. So I'm actually doing six books. So I've got two biographies. All right. The first one is Eleanor of Aquitaine, a biography by Marion Mead. And that was published in 1991. And the second one is Nora, a biography of Nora Joyce by Brenda Maddox. And that one was published in 1998. So this is the only book thing that has sort of a personal connection for me. So I named my daughter Nora, and the female subjects of these two biographies are some of the reasons why. So the first book about Eleanor of Aquitaine is about her. She was both the Queen of England and the Queen of France. So she was the wife of Henry II. And also the wife of Louis VII. And she was also the mother of Richard the Lionheart and King John. And King John is the one who signed the Magna Carta. So, you know, these were like big royal families. And some consider her the most powerful woman of 12th century Europe. And so for a time, she was even locked away by Henry II. If you've seen the film Lion in Winter, starring Katharine Hepburn, that movie is about this period of time. Anyway, Eleanor of Aquitaine, she was just a kick-ass woman and worthy of respect. And so that's the first book. The second one is about Nora Barnacle Joyce. And she was, you know, she was very different from Eleanor. She was born in Ireland. She was poor, mostly uneducated, but she ended up becoming the wife and muse of James Joyce. She was strong and free thinking, and she should really get more credit for her role in helping James become the writer that he became. Like, without her, it's not certain that James would have done what he did as far as his writing. And so I always like the name Eleanor, and a derivative of the name Eleanor is Nora, and then Nora Joyce. And so those, you know, were two of the reasons why I thought Nora would be a great name for a daughter. So Eleanor of Aquitaine, a biography by Marion Mead, and Nora, a biography of Nora Joyce by Brenda Maddox.
Well, my last one, I'm going out with a bang. My last one is Fair and Tender Ladies by Lee Smith. This was published in 1993. And I found this book as a new mother to two small children when we first moved to Eastern Kentucky, when my husband took his first job as a physician. We were there because of the government program at the time where they would pay for your medical school if you agreed to serve in an underserved area for so many years, sort of like, you know, the Northern Exposure example that I gave a couple weeks ago. And so the library of our new town was small, and it was not at all what I was used to. But I found this book, a paperback that was a little worse for wear, on a spinning rack, and I checked it out, not knowing anything about it. This is a historical fiction novel set in the mountains of Southwest Virginia, part of Appalachia in the early 20th century. And we follow the character of Ivy Roe from adolescence to becoming an old woman through her letters. This is a family saga, but it's also a book that has a strong sense of place about leading a life in Appalachia. And we also get a history of the time as well, as she talks about lumber companies, coal mining, the flu coming to their town, the different world wars, and the births and deaths of her own family. Smith does write in a local dialect, so beware of that, but I didn't find it that hard to understand. I love this book. Even though she's writing these letters to her loved ones, as a reader, I felt like she was writing them to me. And I imagined Ivy like my own grandmother, who also grew up in the mountains of Appalachia. And for that, I am forever grateful. And this is a special book for me. Again, the name of that one is Fair and Tender Ladies by Lee Smith.
All right. Well, I'm going way, way, way back on a backlist here.
Oh, wow. What's your last one?
But I am going back to 1895 for this one. So this book is called Jude the Obscurer by Thomas Hardy.
Okay.
So I studied in college over in the UK for about 2.5 months and read a lot of Thomas Hardy. I think I read Jude the Obscurer after I got back. And there is also a film version called Jude from 1996 that stars Kate Winslet and Christopher Eccleston. And so between the book and the movie, I can see why this book, when it came out, was so controversial. So it's the story of Jude Foley, a young boy who wants to become a scholar, but learns stonework to sort of help pay for it. Ultimately, he realizes that he's never going to go to university and he's always going to be a laborer. He marries a woman named Arabella, but that marriage is doomed pretty early on. And he eventually falls in love with Sue Brideshead, who's his cousin. In the book, they live together and have children together without the legal bond of marriage. And so, of course, society turns against them. And when Jude gets sick, the family's life spirals, which causes their young son to take dramatic action. So this book is a gut punch. And the movie is a gut punch. So if you like historical fiction, if you like hard reading, like emotionally hard reading, Jude the Obscurer might be for you. Again, Jude the Obscurer by Thomas Hardy.
Wasn't there a more recent adaptation? I thought there was one that had maybe Carey Mulligan. Maybe I'm thinking of...
It was Far from the Madding Crowd.
Oh, okay. Never mind. Was it also by him?
Yes, he wrote that one. Yeah, okay. Yes, Far from the Madding Crowd. And that's a good movie, too.
Okay. Well, we talked about old books today that we just can't get out of our heads. And we hope that maybe some of these will be books that maybe you want to read. They definitely deserve a chance at a spot on your TBRs. If you want to write into us, we'd love to hear about some books that take up space in your head. Send them in. So we're going to take a short break. And when we come back, I'm going to talk to our reader in the wild, my husband, Chris, about sci-fi fantasy. So I am here with one of my favorite readers in the wild, my husband, Chris, who is an avid sci-fi fantasy reader. So I thought that I would have him on to tell us a little bit about new and notable sci-fi fantasy books that he's been reading lately. Hey, Chris.
Hello. How you doing?
Okay, so you have been a big sci-fi fantasy reader for a very long time. In fact, last year you took me to the Hugo Awards and you're a voting member of the Hugo Awards. How many years has that been?
Last 5 or 6 years. I don't always vote, but the Hugos are a fan-based award. And so anyone who pays a relatively small fee to be a member gets to vote.
What have you been reading lately?
The most recent book that I finished and really liked was a new debut book by Emma Ter's Inkblood Sister Scribe.
Would this fall into the sci-fi or the fantasy?
This is fantasy, and it is in the more subgenre of magical realism. So it's set in what would be normal today that you would recognize, except for a little bit of magic added. It centers around two sisters. And they know and have access to magical books, which have been written in the past, and they've been written in blood, which seems to be the only way the magic works. And the novel starts out as kind of a magical mystery with their father having died reading a book that is a magical book, and they don't know why. There's one sister that lives kind of isolated for her protection in Vermont, hidden by magical wards because someone's always trying to kill them. And the other sister, for reasons that aren't clear as the novel starts, has to travel and leave where she lives every year. And as the novel starts, she's on a research station in Antarctica, as far away as she can get from people.
So this is basically like our world, but the magic part is the books and the writing in blood.
Yes.
Okay. Awesome. So what did you enjoy about it?
So it was well written. It was high quality prose, and it had an interesting mystery story that was almost like a magical Agatha Christie, but you couldn't quite guess what was going to happen because you didn't always know the rules of the game. So as the protagonist didn't really understand how everything works, neither do you as the reader, which allows for several different plot twists to happen to surprise you and keep you guessing about what's going on.
Well, that sounds like one that I would like. Do you think I would like this one?
Yeah, I think this is in the spectrum of the books that I like that might barely cross over into the spectrum of books that you like.
So earlier in this episode, Carrie was talking about the three-body problem and how she read the book while she watched the limited series, and she recommended doing that. Did you read the three-body problem?
I did. I read the three-body problem, but I read it shortly after it was translated into English, so it's been several years, and I have not seen the show yet.
We're going to watch it. Okay. I want to see the show. But do you think that that's a book I would like?
I do not think that's a book you would like.
That's what I told her in this episode.
I think that's a book that maybe it would be better if you saw the movie.
Very good. What are you reading right now?
I am reading Children of Earth and Sky by Guy Gavriel Kay. And it's a bit of an older book, maybe 10 years old. It's a different kind of fantasy. It's almost entirely historical fiction, also with just a very little bit of magic thrown into that. Probably not even magic, just a little bit of weirdness, spirituality.
So do you think this would be considered historical fantasy?
I guess. I've never really seen anything done quite like he does it, because he's got a series of books that could definitely be set on Earth around the 15th century. But even though there's a boot-shaped island of powerful but independent city-states, it's not Italy, it's Pateria. And even though there's a city built on lagoons where there's a bunch of merchant princes and bankers, it's not Florence. It's got a different name. And there are religious conflicts between three different monotheistic religious groups. One who has a son of a god who died for our sins, but he's not Jesus. It's something different. And then there's a group of people before that who are not Jews. They've got a different name. But for all intents and purposes, everything is as it would have been in that period of time, including historical events.
He's just changed the names?
He's just changed the names of everything. You can clearly recognize them for all for what they are. And I don't really know why he made that creative choice,
I know you have read many of his books, so you enjoy
them. They're very good. They're very well done. And like I said, they do follow historical events. There's the not Muslim invaders who conquer the not Constantinople and rename it not Istanbul, but something different, and all of the various
But the fantasy part there. Is what? The fantasy part is the...
It's a little different in each book. The only thing so far that has happened in this book that's a little bit fantasy is one of the many characters' grandfather has died, and as soon as he died, she can hear the grandfather in her head. He speaks to her in her head. His spirit is still there with her, which is mostly comforting to her. But luckily, she does have the ability that he really doesn't like to shut her out of her mind, which usually happens during a romantic interlude where she's not interested in her grandfather seeing through her eyes and offering commentary on her life. But there's 20 or 30 other characters and nothing magical or mystical is happening. And you could even see it as her hallucinating, but it is not. So it's 98% not magical or mystical or anything weird going on, but there's just a tiny little element in each of the stories.
Okay, so two fantasy sci-fi authors for you to check out, Guy Gabriel Kay and Emma Terse. Well, thank you, Chris, for joining me on this Monday morning after we've had our coffee to be my reader in the wild.
You're welcome. I appreciate the nepotism.
You're a nepo baby. So next week, we will have a remix episode while we are at the LA Festival of Books. We will catch up with author Ellen Burkett Morris. We first spoke to her in 2020 about her short story collection, Lost Girls, and now she has recently published a novel titled Beware the Tall Grass. So we will hear a little something old and a little something new from her in that episode. We'll see you next week. Happy reading. For show notes for any episode, go to our website at perksofbeingabooklover.com. We're also on Instagram at perksofbeingabookloverpod and on Facebook at perksofbeingabooklover. To send us a message, go to our website and click the contact button.
If you like listening to us each week, tell a friend or write us a review on your favorite podcast platform to help other book nerds find us. Or you can always message Amy. She would love to hear from you no matter what you have to say.
Finally, a huge thank you to Forward Radio 106.5 FM, a grassroots community radio station in Louisville, Kentucky. You can find our show there, live or in archives, at forwardradio.org.